podcast. I'm recording from my palatial suite on top of the Maritime Hotel in New York. Brought in somebody today who does not have, well, he's got a strong culinary vibe, which we'll talk about as we share a common love for a certain ovoid item. But this is a guy who is one of the few people that has been able to walk up to me and then get me to voluntarily hand over large sums of money in a relatively short amount of time. Well, not large sums of money, but large for me. Anyway, Robert Sparks, I call him Sparks. Thanks for coming to the show. You are an art dealer, but you're also an educator. I will admit that I met Robert Sparks one day down in Soho, outside of the gallery where you no longer are every day, but you're still part of the gallery there, the Martin Lawrence Gallery, a big part of it. David Rogas, company. But I'm standing there one day in the afternoon. It was summer, and it was getting ready to rain, and I was kind of taking refuge there by your doorway. And out comes this dude with white hair and a lot of tattoos. Who came out, and you recognized me from Food Network. And you started talking about art in a way that was hooky and kind of crazy. And you invited me inside, and you talked to me for a couple of hours. And then I remember leaving. I walked out, and I picked up my phone and called up my wife and asked to buy a poster of a can of soup. And it was kind of downhill from
soup.
Some, you know, and it's really funny because I have three of those Warhol soup cans now.
You know, I ask people all the time who want to, you know, people are very humble, and they say, I don't understand art, blah, blah, blah. And I tell them it's a pretty simple litmus test. Just ask yourself why that soup can is in every book on modern art, and recognize the fact that Warhol didn't interpret the can in any way. You and I would have gotten a D in art class for what he did, but he was making a statement. And by not, you know, transforming the can into some other aesthetic ideal, he was able to make this statement, and of course it was what made him famous. And once people wrap their head around that, you know, I think it opens the doors to consider everything. You know, Duchamp's toilet on the table on
or
down
mutt.
The line. Yeah, there you go.
How did you... You're a rock and roll guy, and you've got a lot of rock and roll guys on your person.
I seem to specialize in that.
In the form of various bits of ink inside your skin. I don't know how many actual guys you've got on there. I know there are a few.
I don't know if I even counted them.
You might.
15 or 20 years. So.
I like the story you tell about the day that you showed Peter Gabriel.
You know, I've been able to... I've got up the sleeve the portraits of about 20 rock stars, all sort of in this Raphael-esque, you know... faux watercolory kind of, or
who was the first
stained glass
one? Who was
window.
The first one?
The first one's Johnny Cash, and Buddy Holly on the other side. Buddy Holly's holding Lou Reed's album on Death and Dying called Magic and Loss, and then each guy's handing a record up the sleeve. But the neatest thing is being able to show some of the guys that are on the sleeve the tattoos. And, you know, you don't want to run up screaming hysterically, but if they're interested, and we put a lot of effort into respectful caricatures. And I remember once, perhaps the crankiest guy on my arm is Michael Stipe. And I showed Michael the tattoo. I said, well, listen, I've got a tattoo of you. Would you like to see it? And he grumbled and mumbled, and I pulled my sleeve up, and he said, huh, it's good. And he was just completely surprised. And so that I took that to be a big compliment, you know. But it's neat, you know, to be able to actually have that interplay and that access, and that's what New York affords. And even when I met you, I knew who you were. And as I'm sure a lot of your fans have done, I thought, you know, this is a guy whose brain I would get along with. My brain would get along with his brain. And so when you walked up there that day, I thought, holy mackerel, I came out and mugged you, and I'm glad I did.
You were like... Hey man, let's talk. And we literally, you taught me a semester of modern art history in about a 3-hour period, and then now I've got books stacked all over my house, and I'm constantly trying to make wall space and actually have a bank account just to put money in to save up for things.
So that
one of these days when you send me something with an obnoxious price tag on it,
there
I'll be able to say,
go.
Yeah,
we'll
baby, and add 10%.
That's for me.
But I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on here, besides you're a cool guy and I like you, is this notion that you know, you opened up this whole world for me. And granted, it's a first world kind of problem or a first world thing of, you know, hey, I collect art. But, you know, it's funny when the market tanked a few years ago, and my wife and I decided, let's put it on the wall. And so we started buying art. And the point is, art affects people. And I didn't know this. I didn't really get... I've hung out in museums my whole life. I'm not like you. I can't make a lecture out of the Met, although I'd like to get your lecture on the Met one day. But I've always been someone who's been drawn to art on walls and drawn specifically to painting. But it wasn't until I put a couple of things on my own walls that I really realized the powerful effect that art has. And I think that in this day and age, it seems to be especially true. And not just because we don't know what anything's worth anymore, but there's something about human endeavor that is unique in what we see on walls, whether it's a living guy or a dead guy. And I'm just curious how that affects you, how you even got into this to begin with, because it seems an odd choice.
Well, let me touch on the human endeavor point, because that's really dead on. And not to be preachy, I'm a man of faith, a lousy example, but that's my gig. And I've taken great pride in the fact that when every market tanked, from the stock market to real estate to gold to everything, the one thing that the wealthy, the people that were, you know, really had cornered the market on money, felt there was value in, or the one thing the world felt there was value in, was human creativity, was treasure. You know, a painting that some guy painted alone in an attic crying his heart out over some woman, years later, it's worth $60 million. It's fascinating. And I got into this because I was a waiter in fine dining restaurants.
I can completely see that.
There you go, buddy. That's where I got all my sales skills. But the thing was, it allowed me, in my restaurants, if a client was upset, a customer was upset, they would pull the waiter and send me to the table. And I never, ever fail. And I knew in the long run that I was a good salesman, but being a waiter allowed me a lot of freedom. I didn't have to take the job home at night. I even settled in at very high-end restaurants working the morning shift so that I could be off at 2 o'clock every day and go do anything I wanted to do. But one day it was enough. And what I did was I had this little trick. I'd read every ad in the paper except being a doctor. And I stumbled on a picture framing position. I had framed pictures for art galleries 20 years before in high school. I went down, I took the job. They fired me after 3 days because I didn't know any of the new equipment. I just couldn't keep up with the Christmas rush. But apparently I couldn't keep my yap shut either, because the manager
said... Shock, surprise.
There you go. The manager said, "You're fired. We're letting you go. Would you like to work in the gallery?" I said, "Holy smokes." And off we went. And
did they literally? We're going to fire you from this, but we're going to move you over here.
I mean, listen, if you'll let me go, I'll tell you, it gets even better. They put me in a van. I was covered in sawdust from shaven frames and overalls, and they took me to the gallery to see if the manager would like me. She was on the phone, and I sold a painting to a woman in the gallery while I was waiting. This woman was standing there. No one was talking to her. I talked to her for about an hour about these paintings. She said, "I'll take this one," and I didn't have to interview after that. But the thing is, the reason that you got involved, the reason I got involved, and the reason all this stuff has grown so much in value is something that a lot of people don't conceive. And that's the notion that the modern art era, it has a name because it's a thing in itself, not unlike the Renaissance. Before the modern art era, before the Civil War, for example, there weren't tons of galleries everywhere and hotshot painters. There were several hundred years before. And then there were eras for the composer and eras for industrialization and on and on and on. Things come and go. But the only big, big explosion in art had been the Renaissance. And then beginning... Some people begin it with Picasso. I take it way back to Mary Cassatt, you know.
Mary Cassatt, the beginning, the first real modern artist.
There you go. Mary Cassatt. This wonderful thing happened. A Japanese cultural tour hopped its way around Europe. And one of the stops...
And what year is this? Set this up in context.
Oh, gosh. Man, I'm going to embarrass myself now. 1860s.
All right.
1870s, something like that.
Late 19th century.
Yeah. And so what happened was... And I should know my dates, but, you know, people get caught up. So the notion is, though, this tour went through... through Paris, and Mary Cassatt saw the Japanese woodblock prints, you know, Hiroshige and those cool things of the wave crashing and all that stuff. And no one had ever blocked up color like this before, and she thought it was rather fascinating. So she went home and got this buddy of hers, Degas, who was a much older gentleman, but they were good friends. She takes him down. Next thing you know, she does this set of etchings called the Ten, and you know, I'm not going to put down anyone else's scholarship on this, and they shouldn't put down mine. It's no real, you know, it's everybody can pick and choose when this all began, but that's when I started. And then you get through the Impressionists, who blurred everything. Then Cezanne chopped it all up, and then Picasso put it all in a blender, and on and on and on, until finally they reduce everything down to dripping the paint on the canvas. And what are you going to do after that? And then, holy smokes, Warhol comes along with a soup can, with just a soup can, tomato soup. And
screen printed.
Yeah, and it was fine wine for everybody. It because it was so conceptual that if you didn't get it, you still knew it was something good, you know, because people were jumping up and down and going crazy. And he really played into who Americans were after World War II. We know this, you know.
Consumers.
Consumers. And they were proud to be consumers. They were proud that they could put soup on the wall and that they could feed themselves, you know. And it's all very introspective. You know, it's navel-gazing at a certain point. And it's funny because Warhol, if to digress a little bit, Warhol knew what I call the cult of canvas, which is a lot of people, if they're not willing to do their homework, just think everything that's painted is better than everything else, that a print must be a copy, you know, paintings, paintings, paintings. So Warhol takes these prints and starts printing on canvas, and lo and behold, here come the rich buying them up. Smartest artists that probably ever lived. And then you went through the graffiti era. I wrap everything up a little bit probably with Keith Haring's iconography on the subway. We're moving into this sort of text-based language. You know, kids are not going to grow up using cursive anymore. They're going to be using icons and symbols. And Keith Haring, I own a door that he drew a radiant baby on once. And
I've seen it.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous thing, and it's a relic as much as anything else. And the gentleman that got it showed it to Keith, and Keith said, I did that. I drew that door on the baby on the door. And the gentleman said, well, would you like to sign it? And Keith said, I tagged it.
Tagged it.
And walked off. And so that was the sell to me. So, it really, from that point on, not to belittle anyone, but things do tend to recycle. You know, there's nobody's really saying anything new. And the interesting thing, in my opinion, is the thing that killed the modern art era wasn't just the drop-off of invention. Because the modern art era, what's good is not based on talent. It's based on invention. You know, you could be the best painter in the room and no one will remember you if you don't invent something. And so...
So it's a conceptual movement as much as it is a skill.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that goes to say that even the guys that are stars, like if Jackson Pollock is, he became irrelevant at a certain point as well. Nobody was jumping up and down about Pollock in the mid-70s. You know, everybody has their day. But once they stop inventing, you know. So what happened, in my opinion, was in the late 50s, rock and roll came along. And people started to be able to empathize with an art form that was much more immediate. They could turn on the radio. They could go buy a record. I mean, look, man, I know you love The Night Watchman by Rembrandt. You know,
hard not to.
There you go. I love The Figure Five by DeMuth, but nobody goes to a museum to sit in front of a painting and cry when they're sad. Maybe if Guernica's down the street. What you do is you put on a Billie Holiday record. There you go. You put on a Billie Holiday.
Guernica's
if you're outside of Guernica, if you're outside of Spain, you put on a Billie Holiday record. And you get sad. You put on a Kate Bush record, you get sad.
Or Nina
you,
Simone for me.
There you go. You get excited and you put on, you know, Van Halen or whatever's going to fire you up. And then MTV came along, which I think was the nail in the coffin for the whole thing, because it gave people the different visual art. And that's even evident in the fact that a lot of the big 70s bands probably would never have gotten signed today because they just weren't what I call MTV pretty. And so today we have
The Ramones.
There you go. The Ramones. I mean, Nazareth. Any of these old, crusty, nasty-looking bands. God bless them. But the problem there is you end up in a world where all the arts are now blurred, where a good crooner can't get up and sing without six background dancers because dance has to be part of it. I'm often baffled by these women who work so hard in their career, have such beautiful voices, and yet need to sexy it up so much on the cover. So, really... What happened was people started to look around. I trumpeted it for a good decade and realized, hey, this modern art era, not only is it over, it's not going to just spark back up like a untended fire. It's over. And this stuff is treasure. And there's Picasso paintings just sitting there, and Warhol's just sitting there. And pretty soon, people started quietly buying it up, and then it's all driven by rarity. And now you've got paintings going for 100 to 250 million. Listen, you'll see a $500 million painting within the decade. No question about it.
Yeah, it'll probably be a Damien Hirst.
Yeah, I understand. You know, the problem is, it's very interesting. He's a punk rocker. And again, the punk rock credo is eat the rich and don't play the game. But he played the game in a big, big way. And then he decided in a strange fashion to go back to the street and make his art affordable to all the people that he grew up with. But that's taking Ferraris and putting 15 grand price tags on them. It dilutes the brand a little bit. And then not only that, but frankly, when money's tight, you just don't need to buy what will probably still be there when money comes back. You know, you and I both collect Murakami prints, and the thing that's so wonderful about that is he's stayed very real with his pricing. He hasn't been pretentious in any way.
You can afford them.
Oh, and they're wonderful. But at a certain point, you have to pay homage to history. And the thing that tilted the scale in Hirst's favor, and in some of the young artists' favor, is the fact that the avant-garde today, it's not a street business anymore. The avant-garde doesn't care about the man on the street knowing who Warhol is.
Who does the avant-garde care about?
They want Matthew Barney at their parties. They want Bjork singing. They want things that are so esoteric. And so what they end up with is, this is our abstract artist, this is our pop artist, and we're done. These are our token guys. We don't really need 50 pop artists like in the 70s and, you know, all these guys. And so you have the certain guys can become stars overnight by virtue they're the only guy out there. I mean, I remember when Peter Doig's paintings started selling for $1 million a piece, and everybody was like, good gravy. And the worst part was the young money who would... It's really the biggest problem, to digress a little bit.
Okay, digress away.
All right. The internet, it's made everything very transparent, which in my opinion is wonderful. It's been very good for my business. But the problem is, art is based on two things. If it's a painting, it's based on, is it a good painting? Your experience judging these things, how it looks, you know, the density of the painting. But prints are collectibles. And like comic books or stamps or everything, condition is king. So what happens is the wholesale market's prices are all over the internet, but no condition reports. And so I'll sell someone a print. I'll show someone Roy Lichtenstein's American flag at $125,000. But if I show it to someone and they go down to street to another dealer and says, Sparks just showed me Lichtenstein's Forms in Space for $125,000. That evening, they'll get an email from that dealer showing that that print traded at Christie's a year ago at $60,000. But the dealer will have cut the condition report off. And this young guy who's so confident with what he reads on the internet wants this deal so badly. So he'll call me and say, well, listen, so-and-so has it at $60,000. Or they'll often say, I don't want to tell you where I found it at $60,000, as if I don't know all my competition.
Yeah.
Right.
As if it's a mystery to you.
Well, we're the biggest buyers, so most dealers offer us the art first to begin with. So chances are it was shown to us 6 months ago at $60,000. That's a wonderful wholesale price. At $125,000, that's way more profit than I would need. I mean, my wholesale cost is higher than $60,000 for that print, so why wouldn't I buy it at $60,000? But this young man wants so badly to find something that no one else has found. And it's what, you know, the con man game. It's the notion of the word to con is confidence. But my problem with that is, most people will say, this person gained my confidence, and I don't think that's true. I think these guys give their confidence away because they want it so badly. So the guy will call me and say, some dealer has it for $60,000. I'll say, listen, $60,000, you're going to have condition issues. I'll say, no, he says it's mint. I say, of course he says it's mint. But imagine it is mint. Just say it is mint. Is that a good buy? And I'll say it's not mint. I say, but imagine it is, because he just wants it so bad. And so what you end up then with is a whole generation of people who tried to buy better, discovered this sport, and then within a month find out that someone buys low and sells high, and they're going to go do this themselves. And so they either buy stale art, bum art that no one wants, or they buy damaged prints. And then when the market tanked, these guys all came to us. Will you buy these prints? And they were either common prints that we had six of in the vault already. Like you and I like to collect trial proofs.
Trial proofs. You taught me that's where it's at.
There you go, baby.
And trial proofs, of course, somebody like Warhol who's making a print, tries out different ink combinations,
right,
different colors,
right,
but he only does a unique of potentially each one, of that one. So it's a unique imprint.
Right. And but Warhol takes it another level where he knows trial proofs are going to be valuable. So most trial proofs are the rejects. You print 30 different prints. You pick one that's got the perfect color combination. The rest are rejects, trial proofs. But Warhol, knowing these are going to be more valuable eventually, and also knowing he's making his multiples by hand, makes the trial proofs generally very elaborate. Like
more trouble than they're worth, in a way.
There you go. So he can have a Dracula with diamond dust in 14 colors, where the regular edition is black and gray. Yeah. And so he can print those quickly. So what he does is he dies holding those. He's a smart cookie again, and I think he knew what those would be worth. But when the market tanked, I'd have these young guys come to me, and they'd say, here's General Custer. It's a wonderful print, and it is a wonderful print. But we would have five or six of them because we buy art to store. We have a standing order for these things. And even if we have to overpay for something, we have 80 salesmen to feed and a reputation to keep up. So any mint condition Custer, if it's reasonably priced, we're going to buy it, even if we overpay for it and put it in a vault for a couple years. So this young man would come to me. Do you want my Custer? I'd say, sure, but I'm not going to pay you top dollar. I have six of them already. Do you have a trial proof of Custer? But the problem was he didn't want to spend that money at the time because he wanted, I missed the boat on that, let me go get the better thing, what he thought. And so, the lower buy. So he would skip out on artists like Warhol. He'd say, well, I missed the boat on Warhol. I'm like, look, you're a hedge funder. You have a lot of money, respectfully said. You didn't miss the boat on Warhol. You just want something.
You let it go by.
You want to discover something. You don't want to pay a top price. You're not going to skip on the guys that are in the MoMA and in every museum in the world and have wonderful auction records. And so, though these guys' market goes up, the minute the market tanks, nobody has to buy this stuff. It's going to be around later. And so, no one does buy it. And so, guys like Hearst, even some of the most expensive Murakami sculptures and such, they were really floating up pretty high, and so they became more affordable. Now, a lot of those guys' market has come back up, but I still don't buy them. I tend to stick with the old dead guys, as I like to say. But
they're not making any more of them.
They're not making any more of them. But again, you have to be iconic and buy the right thing. We bought some interesting things lately. I mean, we went to an auction. We've got this amazing piece right now. We went to an auction. Whenever you go to an auction, if you're a responsible dealer, you look through the catalog, decide what interests you, then you go to inspect it or you send a team out to inspect it. Then you send back a report. It's an entire page-long report. You read it, you decide if you're going to bid on it. Then you come up with your bid range. Mm-hmm. You say, okay, it's going to open the bidding at 100. I think this thing could be resold at 300, so I'm willing to bid up to 230 on this or 240 or whatever it is.
And that's it, I'm out.
And that's it. And you have to be disciplined. You must be disciplined because most dealers can go to a big house auction. Okay, I shouldn't say most dealers. If you're a A-level dealer, you've got a lot of bank behind you. But most dealers, street-level dealers, could go to a Sotheby's and Christie's auction literally with 100 grand to spend. And they're trying to buy four Warhols. Now, with 100 grand,
How do you buy four Warhols with 100 grand?
You buy the damaged ones. You buy the ones we pass on. You'll notice at Sotheby's and Christie's, not to dog them, but no print passes. No Warhol print's going to pass next season. And none of them are in mint condition. Who's buying them? Right there. So what happens is we will go to an auction and we can buy 10 $100,000 prints. The other guys might, in the first 2 hours, spend all their money. So we went to this auction to buy a collage of Mick Jagger. It's like nothing you've ever seen. About six levels deep, paper, vellum, scotch tape, torn strips of colored paper, completely rendered. It's like a darn layer cake, signed Andy Warhol across the bottom. Thing's going to bid at 75K, and we're going to bid up to 200 on the thing. The auction goes on and on. Dealers in the room are doing what they're doing. The thing comes up at auction and no one bids on it. Most of these dealers can't buy to store like we can. They can't buy like, oh, I think I can sell this. Well, maybe the Miami Gallery will sell this. Most dealers buy what they think they can sell already.
What am I going to have tomorrow?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So even though we paid opening bid $75K for this, we bought 30 other items. You know, we might have dropped $2 million in that sale. So we had gone with the notion of spending $200,000 for this item and then selling it at like $265, maybe full price $285. But then the question becomes, now we're stunned. We bought this thing at opening bid. No one bid against us. Some people like to say, I'm sitting amongst morons. But what do we do? How do we price it? So it kind of depends. Sometimes you flip things to favored clients. Sometimes you say, look, your buddy's under duress. He's got a Ferrari Modena, and he says, give me $80K right now. You're not going to flip it to me for 90 because you're a cool guy. You just made a bigger profit. You're right. Going to sell it for what it's fairly priced at. And so maybe 3-4 times a year we just steal something, but every once in a while we drastically overpay. We've set a lot of world records because we know we've been in business 20 years. We know darn well we're going to need this art in 2 years. So if we buy something, stick it in a vault for a couple of years, pull it out. We had a Mick Jagger suite we sold a couple of years ago that we bought in 1984. And so we sold it way
under. Held it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've
for that amount of time.
Oh, sure. I mean, here's what you'll enjoy. Here's the saying in art. You get rich buying and selling art. You get wealthy holding it. So the longer we hold things. I mean, we've had people come into our gallery and say, this was on the wall 6 months ago. No one's bought it. Are you going to lower the price? Like, no, not exactly. Chances are if the market trades up this fall, I'm going to raise the price on it. Because we don't sell in consignment. Everything is ours. This is our investments, too. This is our holdings as well. But sometimes we buy well. Like the we bought a big collection of Sam Francis canvases.
Sam Francis, by the way, for those of you who don't know,
abstract expressionist.
Abstract expressionist, mm-hmm. Who I find far more enjoyable and far more talented than Jackson Pollock.
It's a good argument. He, Pollock invented. He made a statement. He invented and made a statement. But the thing that's fun about Francis is he's more like Kandinsky. It's control versus chaos. He lays out these lines and then he builds universes within them. But the thing about Francis is he knows he's going to die. And like Chagall and Herring, he does greatest hits on the way out the door. He holds up in this, sort of a Jasper Johns type barn, and does this collection of paintings called The Last Works, and then he dies. Interestingly, the collection was kept together. Like, you could not, with all the money in the world, you could not go collect 50 Francis canvases. You just couldn't go find them and buy them. They just don't exist. So there's this collection of 50 paintings. Great opportunity for a dealership with 80 salesmen and tons of clients. And so we wanted to buy the collection in 1998, but we couldn't buy them. We were outbid, and they were then owned by Lars Ulrich of Metallica, the drummer.
Sure.
Who you might remember set the world record with a Basquiat a few years. Smart, smart guy, man. So we finally acquired this set of a collection of paintings. Because we had 50 of them, we felt we could price them at less than any auction house would ask. And generally, an auction house is supposed to be the wholesale market. Mm-hmm. It's about a third of our buying every year is through auction. So you're supposed to buy there and sell high. And a lot of people are misled to think an auction record, if we have something at $100,000 and it's sold at auction at $60,000, well, that's the real price, $60,000. And next fall, I'm just going to walk into Sotheby's and point to the counter and say, I'll take that at $60,000 and walk out. They don't realize it's really just a snapshot of a moment. You don't know what the market was like that day, who was in the room, the weather, what art showed up, what didn't. Oftentimes, things listed as not selling or passing were withdrawn from the auction. They just don't tell you that. Things that were sold for a higher bid a week before, costing all kinds of checks to be written, but somebody made a lot of money. It's a very tricky business, but it's not something someone could come in and just figure out on their own. And so as the modern art era wound up, people began to see everything as treasure. Certain countries could show a single work like Guernica and drive their entire tourism network. The certain corporations could put their name on the map, hanging a painting in a place, and certain young people could get famous overnight by buying a famous painting. So it's just a very interesting market, but I wouldn't expect prices to slow down on the big name artists anytime soon, even though time is going by.
Any advice for people who want to get into collecting art but don't think they can? I mean, you run across new.
Oh, yeah. In fact,
I had no idea what I was doing.
Look, one of the hardest parts of my job is the fact that street artists like Keith Haring and even Andy Warhol, who I think was street, even those guys are elitist prices now. They just are. And so it kind of sucks. You get a young couple in that genuinely adore Keith Haring. Not an investing show-off guy. He just adores Haring, can't afford it. So it's kind of sad. So what I say is, listen, here's the rules. You got to have a magic number, first of all. And if you're a young couple and you've got a little bit of money in the bank and you've got your act together, your magic number should be $10,000, maybe even $5,000. And that means you see a piece of art and you love it in a gallery at a show, go ahead and buy it, you know. But if it's over 10 grand, you need to go do your due diligence, because we just saw the entire world's economy tank. If that happens again, you need to be able to resell. And if you do need to be able to resell, it needs to be resellable. That's somewhere near what you paid for it. So the minute you get up over 10 grand, you are investing, no matter what anyone says. If you're not investing, you're decorating. And if you're decorating at 100 grand a painting, you're rolling like I'm not rolling. You know what I mean? And I don't advise that either. So what I say to most people is you get in at $3,500 to $4,500. That's a majority of the art out there. And that, by that, I mean limited edition, beautiful, good print signed by the artist in the frame, and get in at that level. And if it's an established gallery, they'll probably let you trade your art up as you go down the road. But first of all, don't just think, oh, this is beyond me. See, this is what baffles me, Alton. I've got a lot of buddies who are fairly successful in New York, and before the market turned, they watched me buying up tons of Warhol and Herring and everyone, and I'd say, do you want to buy this
stuff? And you
were
buying when you were not a rich guy, by any stretch of imagination.
I lived in a basement flow through in Harlem, and I had a big fat Warhol on my wall over my futon, because it's the only thing I felt value in. You know, I just didn't understand anything else. 30 grand for a car, you know, this for that, this for that. You know, my buddies were buying watches. And they weren't just buying one or two nice watches. They were buying six or seven of them, because the dude in the office before them did that. Frivolous stuff. So I would say to the guys, look, why don't you forget about the investment angle? Do something classy with your money. You know, take the Corvette poster down and put up a soup can, or put up a crawling baby by it. Put up something. Oh, I could never do that. And that's always the reaction. It's very strange, very male thing. But then when the market tanked, a lot of them were really hurting. I get that to a certain extent. But on the other hand, as one of my clients said to me once, Sparks, enough about my kids. You have no idea how much money I'm leaving my kids. And I said, no, you don't get it. We're all leaving our kids money. Leave them some treasure. If your parents passed away a few years ago and left you $2 million, wouldn't you have liked if there had been a Picasso pastel from their trip to Paris in 1958 in the vault? Would have eclipsed all that money? Plus, it's how cool, you know? Well, Sparks, I don't like Warhol. Well, I'll bet you your 3 13-year-old kids are going to adore him. It's a lot sexier product than Picasso or Chagall is. It just is. And yet people don't see beyond the end of their nose. And yet, if you look around your own homes, anybody that's out there listening to this, think about the art on your wall. Guarantee you there's something on your wall that was probably there 5 years ago. And what if that had been something that could have grown? You know, we put art on our walls and we forget about it. And what if it had been something that could have grown for you? So I have art on my walls now I bought 10 years ago. I've completely forgotten about it, completely taken for granted. And I turn around and go, holy smokes! I forgot how much that's worth today. You know, the owner of our company does just that. He takes his money and buys paintings one by one. And you walk into his home, and every once in a while, I'll look at a single painting and think, that could probably fund our company for the next 10 years, that one painting. And yet, the price he paid at the time was probably outlandish to most people. If you'll allow me, remember the Giacometti that just sold for $104 million. $104 million. It sold to a woman who bought it because she liked it. It would fit in her garden. Not for investment or anything. It was only made in 1960, and it's a limited edition of 11. It was made for the plaza outside the World Trade Center, never finished. It was a rejected thing. Paid $114 million for it, and the gentleman that bought it paid six 18 years ago. And not everything happens like that, but my point is all his friends made fun of him at the time. No one had ever paid that much for a Giacometti before. How crazy was he to put six down? When the Picasso painting Boy with Pipe went from 45 up to whatever, if you had looked at precedent, if I had set out and I got this painting, Picasso Boy with Pipe, I want $50 million for it. One might look at precedent and say, well, Picasso's auction record's only 40. Why in the fat would I pay 50 for this? Not realizing no good painting like this has come along in years. Jackson Pollock. I mean, why is his auction record so low? Nobody sells good Pollock. So anyway, it's a tricky, tricky game. But if someone wants to get into it, they need to get into it. It's like getting your first tattoo. You know, you overthink it. You redraw the design for 5 years. You say you're going to do it. But once you do it, just get your toes wet. But don't buy for sake of investment under $5,000 or $10,000. Because everything's an investment. Every art gallery you'll ever go to, it's an investment. It's an investment. Under that price, try to get a handmade print if you can. Giclées are becoming very nice. I'm on the fence about them at this point. Offset lithographs, Murakami's offset lithographs are absolutely breathtaking, embossed and glittery and wonderful. But try to make sure it's a quality print, that it is signed, numbered. It's limited to some extent. It's in a frame with museum plexiglass, so it won't fade. And if it's under $5,000, you're probably doing what you should be doing. But if you see artists like Shepard Fairey, I mean, his prints, when they're released, $40 a pop. You know, a lot of my friends pass on those because they want to buy the expensive ones, which they're never going to write the check for. So they end up with nothing.
Why do you say that they're why would you say they're never going to write the check for it?
It's what I call the Superman dilemma. I get young guys that come into my gallery and they want Warhol's Superman.
Who doesn't?
This is the most expensive print, man. A mint condition Superman is going to cost you $250,000. I don't care what anybody says. And so they want Superman, but they can afford Santa Claus. He's 25K. He's got diamond dust. He's gorgeous. This guy's born on Christmas Day, but he wants Superman. So you know what he's going to do? He's going to go home and think about it.
And do nothing.
Yeah. So a year later, I run into him, and I be a little bit of a jerk, and I'll say, hey, so what'd you get? He didn't get anything. And what he should have bought was Santa. Or two Santas, hung them side by side, because he could have traded them up at any time for Superman. And he would have had something. See, that's the win. The win is not, I discovered art collecting last week, so I'm going to get a better price than everyone else. Or I'm going to buy the next new flash in the pan. The win is the get. The get. And so I've bought 16 Warhols in my life. A couple of them I set the world record on. One of them my friends made fun of me for years for the price I paid. A couple of them I just about stole. But I got all 16 of them. I didn't take a vacation since 1999. I'm not taking a vacation over 3 days since 1999. Bought my first car in 20 years a month ago. Never been anywhere near the Hamptons. But I bought 16 Warhols. And I don't say that to be boastful. I want to be an inspiration. You know, I didn't graduate college. I'm covered in tattoos. I'm not the guy you want your daughter marrying. But I did it. But to me, Warhol was treasure. I mean, it's just like the same thing I said to you, someone said to me, you can own a Warhol. So I can own a Warhol? Then I looked at my bank, I looked at the price, I can own a Warhol. And to me, it was a big honor, it was a big deal. You know, it was a big deal. You and I grew up, we would get Rolling Stone magazine. And on the last page of Rolling Stone, the society page would be Elton John, Tina Turner, and Andy Warhol. He's a rock star, for God's sakes. And his prints are $5,000 a piece, sitting behind couches in galleries. I just didn't wrap my head around that at all, so I just started buying. It's really not as hard as everyone thinks, but if I can roll, it's a crass analogy, but it's art. The painting is often the beautiful girl at the bar, and if she's sitting by herself, you can ask yourself, well, maybe no one else wants her, or maybe I can't afford her, or she must already have a boyfriend. But then there are guys who will go right up and talk to that girl, say hi. You know, and the thing is, it becomes fortune favors the bold.
I've done without certain things in the time that I started buying art from you, so that I could afford the art. And I realized that what I was affording myself at this time in my life is significance. And there's something about, you know, yes, could I stick every dime that I can scrap together into a 401k. I hate to say it, but in the end, it's just money, and it comes and it goes. So to me, it's not, yes, I will pass these things to my daughter, but actually, in the end, I simply like living with the significance of human endeavor.
Yeah, there you go.
And standard. As a creative person, being around these items or being around these objects is a significant source of energy.
Well, that's what's so wonderful about them, and it's illustrated by your attention to trial proof. So trial proof, the artist is at the table.
You're there.
And not only is he at the table with the ink on his fingers, but the coolest part is it's the very moment where he says, the blue isn't working, put the green on. It's like taking a photo of that moment, the creative snapshot, because an hour later they're going to make a print that's completely different. I mean, you're right there at the process. It's really rather fascinating. You know, it's interesting. A lot of collectors, myself included, I've got these Warhols, the Herrings, I've got Lichtenstein's Crying Girl, all this fancy stuff up. But I have this artist named John Jesse, who I think the best working artist working today, young artist, hands down. And I have certain works of his where if the house was on fire, I go for that painting before any of the Warhols. And if it was all that survived, at least I would know I didn't just save value, I saved treasure. Something that means something to me.
Treasure.
You see, treasure.
That's
there it is, treasure. You got to think, man, it's treasure. What does, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I give this wonderful tour that's everything that no other guy would show you. That's my tour. And there is this beautiful little white jade baby, carved about 600 years before Moses. I don't know. It's older than God. And you look at this thing and you think, the guy carving this thing, probably wearing a loincloth and some sandals, and he's banging away at this thing. And did it ever occur to him that in 2 millennia, there'd be a bunch of people with beeping cell phones in this big, glorious building, standing there staring at this thing? It's what we value. It's the thing we're most nostalgic for, because it's a snapshot on what humans are capable of doing. In the end of the day, if another movement in art doesn't come along, dance, music, whatever, even music itself, you know, rock and roll lasted fairly long, and then the movements that have come after them have been shorter and shorter each time. I mean, even music can play itself out. Once rap is rote, what's the next thing? Because once something isn't new, you're just retreading. It's why rock and roll isn't the king anymore. So what would make Warhol prices come down? He would have to flood the market. You know, something would have to come along to replace him. It's just not going to happen. And so I'm very conservative. And to come back to your question of how should a young person begin collecting art, buy magazines like Juxtapose magazine, mm-hmm. buy books on the history of the 20th century art movement. Your timeline means everything. Learn your timeline, figure out what it is you like, and then, you know, get an advisor if you can. Start collecting, but start collecting at under $5,000. After a year or two, move up to 10. But if you do make money, if you get a big bonus and you really want to start buying art, be conservative. If you don't have any kids, do whatever you want. But if you've got kids, be conservative. Stick with the biggest names. Buy Picasso, Warhol, Chagall, Miro, and then put them on your wall. Forget you own them. So it is what it is, but it is treasure. But most important, I'd like to mention one thing. The notion of painting a painting and then making 250 copies of this painting, limited edition, this really only came into vogue over the last 30 years. There are no limited editions of any of Picasso's paintings or Chagall's paintings. When those guys made prints, they made works of art in their own right. A print isn't a copy of a painting. A Picasso print is an etching where he took a copper plate, carved a picture in it, stamped 300 and destroyed the plate.
Or he made a line of cut, in which case he destroyed it as it was made.
There you go. He slowly tore this strip apart. I mean, that's the genius stuff right there. But these things hang in museums. The Metropolitan Museum of Art has his lino cuts. There's a lino cut that sold for over $1 million. You know, there's an etching that sold for over $1 million recently. So what you want to realize is, don't go into a print and say, oh, it's just a print. Where's the painting? That's the one thing everyone does. Where's the original? It's like looking at your friend's triplets and asking which is the original. That's one of my best lessons for anyone. Throw the word original right out the window. And if a dealer starts throwing that word at you, tell him to stop. You want to hear multiple versus unique. Because original is a smoke and mirrors word, in my opinion. I mean, what in the fat is a Warhol original? We had a client once
Would that just be considered a canvas?
But original denotes first. And if he did the canvases, he might have done 30 trial proofs, then the multiple, then he might have gotten on a plane to Paris while the staff does the canvases. Not saying that happened, but I'm just saying it could. The original, the canvas, could have been the last thing that was done. You know, so, and a lot of Picasso's etchings are much, or his lino cuts especially, are much finer than his paintings of the period. You know, you buy what the artist does best, but what you don't want to do is go into a dealer and say, well, where's the original, and then let him convince you that only paintings are the good buy, because that's where he's going to make his money, is on paintings. But basically, you have to get in and Have an advisor. Don't be intimidated. Buy what's real. Don't let what you think you should buy dictate what you buy. Your average print should be $3,500 to $4,500. Get in there and then give me a call.
You ever bought art you didn't like?
Yes. There's a simple trick I use, and it's everyone should do this if they you know, because people are torn. They're never going to resell, but then again, they want a good value.
They want to be able to resell.
Yeah, exactly. So what I do is, if I'm buying a print that I really like from a dealer, and say it's $10,000, well, there might be another one over there that I know is marketable. It's a good print, but I don't really care for it. But I know if I buy both of them, he's going to make me a better price. So I'll buy both of them, then I'll put the one in my basement. And then a few years later, I'll go down and get it and sell it and get all my money back. So I end up owning the first one for free. I've done that a lot. That's what most dealers do. You buy a small set that includes the one you want. Wait a few years, sell the other stuff. It's why people buy suites by Andy Warhol, for example. If you were to buy a Marilyn Monroe suite and hold it for a couple of years, you might be able to unload the 7 that aren't Miami, Los Angeles, and the beloved Black Marilyn.
Right.
You know, and so it's an interesting way to roll. Also, if people have kids, you know, I've had families split suites up, you know, 3 kids and the parents will buy a 5-piece suite or whatever. It's kind of interesting. Here's the thing. You cannot do the sport without your heart. That's going to be my esoteric comment of the day. You just can't. It's been devised by God to be impossible to do unless your heart is involved. Because if you think you can do it with precedent and reports and graphs and charts and, you know, I went to a meeting of investors, and these guys were real investors. So it was all on charts and graphs and pie charts. And I just sat there baffled. No one talked about the quality of the painting. Is it good? Or is it stale? Has anyone ever seen it before? They kept talking about the psychic dividend. They couldn't even say we just like the painting.
The psychic dividend.
We are going to enjoy the psychic dividend in the meantime while it's hanging in the boardroom. And I'm like, you guys, oh, I gotta go. Well, I just left that one because
that'd be great name for a band.
Psychic dividend. Yeah, opening for Devo this weekend. But yeah, so you've got to have your heart into it because. You just can't. It's like trying to taking a class on fine wine and thinking you're going to collect wine and not liking wine. It's just not possible. You have to develop those tastes. But taste comes from study, and it comes back full circle. Why is that soup can in every book? You know, why do we all like wine coolers at 15 and hate Cabernets? You know. You have to give yourself credit. But as you become more educated in anything, you become more enthusiastic and more confident. And I'll tell you, when I bought my first Warhol, I was shaking in my boots. It was 4,000.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Shaking in my boots, man. I didn't know what I had done. My dad thought I was crazy. Everybody thought I was crazy. But I went home and I had a futon and a little TV set and a flow-through basement apartment in Harlem and a big old Andy Warhol trial proof of Mammy on the wall. And I just thought I was the coolest thing ever because I was. but it's only because it's something that I was taught to value as I grew up. You know, art, to value these things. So, you know, it's really rather amazing. And you get to go back to this moment of, would the artist have ever believed this is what would happen? You know, right. This is where this art would end up. You know, I had a Mary Cassatt etching that I sold once that had been kept in a barn during World War I. You know, you and I don't necessarily own this stuff. Someone owned it before us. Someone's going to own it after us. We're caretakers of a lot of this stuff. We really are. You can pretend you're going to own it. I think the only way to own it is to eat it. But you're going to...
Even then,
eventually you don't own it anymore.
I don't think I own anything.
But you're going to give it to Zoe. She's going to give it to her kids. On and on it's going to go. And the other thing is, you do have the right to sell some of it. And then hopefully you buy more. You want to rotate your art
up.
As you go forward.
I love the idea of it. Because how many things can you buy that actually go up in value? There aren't that many.
I can tell you one more interesting little story.
Right.
I gave a lecture to a big group of people once. And at the end of the lecture, as I was leaving, there was a group of Chinese business people standing to the right. And they were having a conference amongst themselves. And as I was leaving, one of them stopped me. and invited me over to their little group, and they all were very happy to meet me. And one of them said, "We've been discussing everything you said, and we've decided you're right, and we're going to buy some art." It was just like that. And I was like, okay. And then off they went. And it ended up they were, they had an exclusive contract to import a very major American brand into China. And so they wanted unique Warhol trial proofs, as I had advocated. And they bought every trial proof I ever had of American subjects. Annie Oakley, if I got it, they bought it. John Wayne, if I got it, they bought it. Uncle Sam, everything.
They didn't buy a Mao.
No, didn't buy a Mao. But one day, it all had to be American, because it was American cars they were importing. But one day, I hit the mother load. I found the most expensive American guy in a print that you can, James Dean. And he was there in the jacket, looking cool against the wall, and I sent it to him, and they said, "Wow, it's amazing, it's gorgeous, all these colors, and we love it, holy smokes." And they didn't say anything else. And they'd never done that. And I said, "Well, so does that mean you're going to buy it?" And the gentleman said, "Oh, no, we can't buy that." And I said, "Why not?" And they said, "Well, he died in a car crash. Bad luck." So they were like, "There's no way we can hang this in our motor company." And right there, I learned a lesson. But so their priorities were one thing, where my Europeans' priorities are another. My Americans' priorities are another. You know, so it's just, it's a global market for a finite product. And it's a finite product that the very wealthy and the very educated and intellectual and museums take very seriously. And so the biggest problem for anyone getting into it is just don't be intimidated by it. Everyone started somewhere. And but believe in yourself and realize you've hit a point in your life. You're 25 years old or beyond. You're paying your bills on time. You've got a little money in the bank. Get those crummy posters down you brought home from college. Take yourself seriously. You got to put something on the wall. And who are you going to be when you're 30 or 40 or 50? You know, I never ever thought I moved here and lived in a van for a week in Greenwich Village and had to borrow cash from my dad just to move here. Never ever would have thought I would own one Warhol, much less a whole art collection. And so who am I going to be at 60? Maybe I will have an apartment on Central Park South. Maybe I will. You never know.
Don't know.
So maybe I better be holding the right art then and not start buying my Warhols then, you see. And so my father, you know, God bless him, shouldn't you have a house before you buy the art? You know, my boss, shouldn't you have a car before you buy the art? I needed a futon and a microwave and my Warhol, and I was good to go, you know. And it was doable. And so I did it. Fortune favors the bold.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, man. Love you.